Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria, and I want to just start today by thanking everybody who has supported the podcast in your way by listening, by downloading? Yeah, that's how you say that. By sharing links on Facebook and Twitter and Insta and all the other places you can share links. And by supporting, I want to thank Scott Kettler. I also want to thank Jeffrey Sewell. And lastly, I want to thank Chuck Pell. Thank you for going to my website, carasantamaria.com, and either clicking on the PayPal button or the Patreon button and pledging to support the podcast. Guys, if you haven't heard, as of last week, I'm new on Patreon. Patreon is a really cool site. It's kind of like a Kickstarter for ongoing projects. So if you're interested in helping support the podcast financially, it's a cool place where you can go do that. And you can also support a bunch of other projects from independent artists. You can even set yourself a monthly limit. Say you only want to give $5 a month. You only want to give $50 a month, whatever it is. It'll prevent you from going over your limit. And you can kind of divvy up how you support different creators in different ways. There's a lot of really cool projects on Patreon. You can get lost just looking at all of the cool things that people are making. So check it out. You can find the click-through link. You can either go to patreon.com/talknerdy or you can go to my website, carasantamaria.com, and you'll see a click-through link there. You'll also, again, just a reminder, you'll see my online store there on the website. Lots of cool Talk Nerdy swag for sale. And also, if you do support through Patreon, you will get a nice little reward that you can use in the Talk Nerdy store. So that's just a little added incentive there. So again, guys, thank you. Thank you for sticking with me through 50 plus episodes. Thank you for all of your support, all of the great comments you send me all the time on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. I apologize if sometimes there's a delay in getting back to you. Sometimes I'm out of town. I'm working on crazy projects, but I always try and go through the list, even if it's a bit delayed, to say thank you and to say hello. I have a new project that just got released, and so I wanted to take just a quick moment to plug it shamelessly. If you go to YouTube, actually, let me look up what the, I'm like doing this as I tell you. If you go to youtube.com/, this probably isn't true. Well, I'll talk about it first and I'll find the URL as I'm working. Basically, I did this really great project with Vice and General Electric, and it's all about like really cool kind of future science. And that was the beginning of one of the episodes. If you heard that, you actually might not have heard that. That might not have recorded, but I just heard it in my headphones. It's called Invention Factory, and I did 5 of the 9 episodes. The other 4 are international episodes with foreign language hosts. I did 5 of the 9. There's one about how robots are going to evolve. There's one about how the mind is going to overcome matter. One about how we will see the invisible, how the world will get smaller. Really, really great concept, really fun, very proud of the work that we did. So you can find it on General Electric, GE's YouTube page, or you can also find Invention Factory on Motherboard, which is a Vice property. So if you Google, you know, Vice Motherboard Invention Factory or Invention Factory General Electric, or you look on that YouTube page, or you just go again to my website, carasantamaria.com, and you click on web, I've got all everything I've ever done on the web, and the top few videos will be this new series. So I've been passing it around in social too, but check it out. I would really appreciate hearing your thoughts on it and showing it some love. Worked really hard on it and got to travel to a bunch of cool places and meet a bunch of really cool people that you'll be introduced to in the show. All right. Enough of that. Enough shameless promotion. I am pleased to present this week's guest. Her name is Tamara Krinsky, and she is a screen and stage actress who is also a member of this great group called Sirens, who work very hard to help promote science literacy and to kind of create characters that carry a strong scientific message. So without any further ado, here she is, Tamara Krinsky. Tamara, thank you so much for joining me on this fine, much too early Sunday morning.
I'm very happy to be here, although yes, you're right. It is very early because it was daylight savings time last night.
Can we talk about why daylight savings time is super stupid?
I think it's an old leftover convention that we could get rid of, don't you?
We could totally get rid of it. I think that there are a lot of things that we as Americans do because of tradition or because of what we once thought was convenience, which is no longer convenient, that actually aren't very healthy for us. Like,
did you have something particular?
Yeah.
In mind?
So, like, daylight savings obviously is really stupid. And there are whole states that are like, we're not going to do it.
Well, I got into a conversation about this the other day, and their whole thing was that it's not about farming anymore. It's actually about shopping.
Oh, God.
And that's actually why it's done now. I do not know if this is based on any sort of scientific fact or study.
I don't even understand how this would help us shop.
Because the idea is that if it stays light longer, then you feel like your day is longer. So that when people get out of work, they're like, oh, I still have hours left in my day. I can pop into Macy's or Nordstrom before going home.
But see, here's what I think is stupid. The days get shorter in winter, right? The days physically get shorter. Like it's darker for longer in the morning and then it becomes darker earlier at night. But we set our clocks in such a way to reinforce that. Like if it was just always daylight savings, maybe instead of doing away with daylight savings, we just stayed sprung forward and we never fell back. Right? Then we would just always have more daylight. Like, I just do not understand the point of falling back. I know for like a second, everybody's excited about it because they're like, ooh, we get an extra hour of sleep.
Right.
But it's like for a second and then you're over it.
And then you have to adjust.
Exactly. And it's bullshit. And everybody, they get super pumped about the whole fall back thing. And then they go to work the next day and they're like, oh, this is hard. Because that's that time of year when you go to work in the dark and you come home in the dark. And yes, I think I kind of get the whole spring forward thing, like let's give ourselves an extra hour, let's get up an hour earlier, but let's just stay this way.
Yeah, I just don't get it.
It's so stupid. But the other thing I was mentioning was the whole convention of it's a whole thing about saving electricity too, which is a weird thing. Like people think that daylight's, I'm like reading about it right now. It was Germany, which in April 1916 first started moving clocks forward by an hour to conserve energy during World War I. See, it's not even a farming thing. Isn't that funny?
We have turned into Snopes.com here.
Exactly. And then we went to daylight savings after the war at the peak of the oil embargo. And yeah, it was to cut back on residential electricity use, which is heaviest at night. By moving clocks forward in the spring, I'm quoting quartz.com here. By moving clocks forward in the spring, human activity would start and end earlier. And when people returned to their still sunny houses after work, they wouldn't need the lights. Mm. The result, energy savings. But there's not really any proof, apparently, that this has had any effect.
Well, there you go. How American is that?
Truthiness, people. Truthiness. It's so bullshit. It's just, it really infuriates me when we make like nationwide sweeping decisions out of fear or out of stress and we don't like back it up with any evidence. So the other thing is this idea of kind of the standard school day, right? That parents send their kids to school basically while they're at work. Like that, the school day is very heavily lined up with a parent's work day. And it has very little to do with the healthy and effective learning times for children and young adults.
It's a big problem, and I actually see both sides of it as I get ready to send my own small child to elementary school next year, to kindergarten next year.
Interesting. Oh, I'd love your perspective on this.
Yeah. It's such a complex topic. So first off, as a working woman, you know, our society is not set up to support women at work and also taking care of children. It's just not. I mean, the school day ends at 2 or 3 o'clock. I don't really know anybody who is allowed to leave their job at 2 or 3 o'clock on a regular basis to go take care of your kids.
That's true. It does end really early. Yeah. And also, we don't have things that, you know, a lot of, I think, more European models that have more kind of socialistic approaches to things have. We don't have help with childcare. We don't have required paid maternity leave like they have in a lot of other countries.
No, there's absolutely, it's ridiculous that we're a first world nation and that doesn't happen. And yeah. that the amount of maternity leave that you can get is so short. But then on the flip side, there's this great book called Nurture Shock, which looks at a bunch of different studies about kids, and it touches on a whole bunch of different areas. But one of the chapters in the book, and I read it a while ago, so hopefully I'm quoting it correctly, is all about the start time for school. And what it does is it looks at the kids and brain development and all of that. And there was actually a study that was done that shows, I don't remember if it's high school or middle school, but that shows that peak performance actually happens later. And so that if you shift kids to starting later, I want to say at least at the very earliest, it was 9, maybe 10 o'clock in the morning, huge range of difference in results and understanding and cognitive abilities. And so,
yeah, and I mean, we're already kind of doing it weird where, like, you're not off of work yet when kids get out of school at 2. So yes, maybe you can drop them off on your way to work, but you can't pick them up. If it were shifted to the other side of the workday, they were getting out at 6 when you're getting out, and maybe they don't go in until 10 or 11 even, I think that we would see a huge difference, because the natural sleep cycle for a kid, like if you were to kind of leave them to their own devices, they would naturally be going to sleep a little bit later and waking up a little bit later.
It'd be nice if that happened. I unfortunately have an early riser who likes to get up every morning at 6.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe that is the case. I think that there are fluctuations right throughout the developmental period where very young children get up with the sun.
Yeah.
But then they nap quite a bit too. There's, you know, they require, because the younger we are, the more sleep we require as we age. Obviously, we need less and less sleep in total, but also in one sitting. But definitely, like, you look at middle school kids and teenage kids, and they naturally want to go to bed late and get up late.
Yeah.
And I think that that doesn't mean that they're lazy. It just means that that's their biology, and their peak performance, you're right, is going to be closer to like lunchtime than 7:30 in the morning.
I don't know anyone who operates well at 7:30 in the morning.
And we're both like, hey, guys. It's like 10 a.m. on a Sunday. We're like, it's so early.
Good morning.
Such whims. So I got to say, I'm so excited to have you joining me. I had I've already had Christina Ochoa on the podcast, and I still haven't yet had Taryn on the podcast. But at this point, I've had three now, including you, I've had three of the four sirens.
Yay!
So I want to talk a little bit about, you know what, when Gia was on, I think it was only 2 weeks ago, Gia Mora, we mentioned sirens, but we mostly talked about Einstein's Girl and like a bunch of weird tangents, which I'm sure you and I will do too. But I thought that having you on, it would be cool to discuss it a little bit, sort of especially in the context of you and your career. So before we jump into what sirens are all about, everybody's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
What sirens?
We'll get there. We'll get there. We'll get there. You just have to.
You're such a tease, Kara.
I know. So you are an actress.
Correct.
And this seems to be a theme with sirens, which we'll get to. You're a kind of a classically trained, kind of. You are a classically trained actress living here in Los Angeles doing stage and screen and also hosting jobs.
Correct,
which
yes.
I share with you, the hosting pain. Pain, I should say pain. A great job. No, I love my job, but there are highs and lows to every job.
It's an interesting thing to try to explain to people what you do.
It definitely is. It definitely is. So I'm interested first in what you're up to now, because I was looking at your resume. I was researching. This is a very rare thing for me. Actually research a little bit. So I was looking at your resume, and you've done a bunch of really cool shows over the course of seemingly kind of a long career. I mean, you were on Seventh Heaven.
I was on Seventh Heaven.
So that shows that you've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
Is why I picked that out. It's like Seventh Heaven. That was like the crowning achievement of your career.
Well, no, actually, the crazy part is, you know, it's like you do all these different things in your career, and some of them are high profile, and some of them are low, and some of them are things nobody hears about yet. They're the most important thing to you.
Yeah.
Whenever I go back home, the thing that people talk about, which is probably the smallest thing in my career, yet still apparently the most visible, is the 15 seconds that I was in Star Trek First Contact, which is the show I got my SAG card on.
That's how you got your SAG card.
That's how I got my SAG card.
That's so funny. And so what was your role? You were in it for 15 seconds. Who were you?
So I am the wide-eyed village girl who represents the next generation as the Vulcans make first contact for the very first time.
I love it. And and your folks were very proud, weren't they?
Oh, my God. Well, not only that, my dad is a huge Trekkie. Like, I mean, he's honestly the reason that I sort of put the blame solidly on him for the interest that I have in science, because I spent my childhood, like, stealing all the Asimov books off of his shelf, and he was always watching Star Trek and, you know, Battlestar Galactica, and, well, I mean, I didn't see him watch Battlestar Galactica, that was a little before my time, but all that kind of stuff. And luckily, he never said, oh, well, this is for boys. Like, that was just not part of what happened in the house. So I blame him. But so here's a very random story, but I'll tell you. So I'm in Star Trek First Contact, and my dad is thrilled, of course. And they're like, oh, you can do this. You can be an actress. You can work. Yay. I mean, they've always been very supportive, but it was like, oh, suddenly they had proof.
Sure. And it's so funny when they pick and choose what their proof is. Like, you're like toiling on an independent film, spending hours and hours and hours and months and months. And then you're like, you get 15 seconds on this one huge show. And they're like, oh, you're like a legit actor.
Oh, yeah. Like the intense family farm drama I shot out in La Salle, Peru, Illinois, and, you know, that. So at the same time around when all of this is happening, my parents are going through adjusting, like, their wills and all of their, like, lifey stuff. Mm-hmm. And they have suddenly told me I have a brother, and they've decided that I am going to be designated as the plug puller if, God forbid, anything happens.
Jesus Christ.
Right. So I get this call from my dad. Hey, Tam, it's Dad. I just want to let you know you're going to get something in the mail soon. It's some papers that I need you to sign. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm kind of freaking out, like thinking, oh, God, these are the plug pulling papers. This is like the agreement I have to make with my parents if, God forbid, anything happens. And I'm, you know, thinking about mortality and, you know, all of that. And this, you know, this FedEx arrives, and I, like, slowly rip it open. And I look inside, and there's a book inside. And it is the novelization of Star Trek First Contact. And it's one of those books where they, like, turn it into a novel, and then in the middle there's a whole bunch of glossy pages with photos from it. And my dear, dear father has gone through and found, like, my little silhouette against...
like you photobombing.
Right, against Jamie Cromwell, who most of my scenes were with. And, like, you know, he's got a little post-it there. Sign here. Love, Dad. Send me your autographs.
So sweet.
Yeah, it was
very sweet. You have amazing parents.
Yeah, they're pretty rockin'. They're pretty great that way.
This makes me so happy. I love to hear stories like that. And it really does reinforce, I think, especially when you've been working really hard at your passion and your craft, and maybe having moments where you question, or maybe not having moments where you question, but just always knowing.
Oh, like, there's always moments where you question. I don't know how you do what we do and not question.
But kind of, you know, and pushing through those and saying, okay, this is what I'm doing and this is what I'm going to do. And then you have these little moments of validation, especially, I think they mean even more when they come from people who you love,
absolutely.
From family and friends. Oh, that makes me so happy.
Yay, warm fuzzies on a Sunday morning.
Warm fuzzies on a Sunday morning. So you're working hard as, I would say, a pretty non-traditional, quote-unquote, Hollywood actress, because you do have a lot of, I'd say, stage experience, which not all people in L.A. have. There is, I think, a vibrant theater community here, but it's obviously not the same as we would assume as the theater community in New York. And so I think a lot of people identify L.A. actresses as, like... I don't know. I think there's just this concept that comes up in your head when you say, oh, you're an actress.
I've lived with that my whole life. Yeah. And it's, I mean, honestly, it's one of the reasons I'm really, really glad to have the community of Sirens and, you know, like, adjacent, I would say, to Nerd Brigade and all of that, just because it's so bizarre to be in a profession where so much of your life you're told don't think, or it's assumed that you are not smart.
Exactly. Like, even if it's not the case but it is the case. But even if you look past the idea of going to auditions and needing to be a carbon copy of a bunch of other people, or dealing with people, unfortunately, directors or producers or different people who don't reinforce a lot of positive behavior, because there are definitely jobs, I'm sure, that mm-hmm. you've had where they were creative and they were intelligent and they were trying and they were emotional. So even if those were the only jobs you ever got, were these jobs that were really, I don't know, personally...
That stretch you, that push
exactly,
you, that really... Yeah.
You would still be dealing with the kind of secondary effects, which are... People, and I'm guilty of it. I'm definitely mm-hmm. guilty of it because I meet a lot of actresses when I go out to, you know, events in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Well, it's a tough, I mean, it's okay. So I'll say a couple of things. So mm-hmm. first off, I feel very lucky also that when I first got out here, I became a member of my theater company, which is called the ANTAUS Company. I'll give you a plug, ANTAUS.org. Check
there
us out.
There you go.
But we are a classical theater company. We focus on traditional classics, you know, that you would think of like Shakespeare and Moliere, but we also do modern classics. We do new translations of old classics and all kinds of interesting things. And we have classes and workshops and whatnot. And it's an incredibly intellectual exercise. Mm. I mean, I sat there the other day reading a new translation of an Italian classic and looking at, you know, we got into this very robust discussion about, you know, how does this mirror the politics that are happening now? How does it mirror the politics that were happening in Italy in the 1820s? And the actors at least that I've been fortunate for the most part to associate with are some of the most curious people that I know. You know, they want, the reason we are actors is because we want to know about what makes somebody tick, what's going on in somebody's head, what was happening in the world around them that informed them at that time. The jobs that let you explore that are fewer and farther in between.
Because, and unfortunately, they're also the jobs that often don't pay that well.
Yeah, there's that. And there's a whole fight happening right now in the LA theater community regarding the 99-seat contract or the 99-seat equity waiver plan.
And what is that? Tell me about that.
Okay. you're going to get a lot of either angry comments. Hopefully I'll sound at 10 o'clock in the morning intelligent about this. But long story short, so Actors Equity is the union that governs stage managers and actors on stage. It's different than SAG-AFTRA,
gotcha,
which is the union for actors on screen. And so Equity, there's been a plan in Los Angeles called the 99-seat waiver plan, which allows actors to do smaller theater productions for very, very, very little money. All of the rules of Equity are in place, like, you know, things requiring bathrooms and certain rehearsal times and breaks and stuff like that.
Sure.
So you're operating in a professional environment. But basically what happened is LA is incredibly unique in the actor infrastructure in that you come out here, you're generally making your living from film and television. But like we were just talking about, you know, if you're going on and, yeah, you're maybe making, you know, your rent because you have three lines on something and you're playing a receptionist and here you go, Mr. Bond, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And that's great, but it's not challenging you. It's not helping you grow as an actor. So, like, for example, with my company, it's a lot of TV and film people who came out from New York and said, great, I want to do all this wonderful TV and film, but I also want to keep doing Shakespeare. You know, I want that chance to play Hamlet. I want that chance to do Chekhov. So they formed a membership company that allows them to do that. And the amazing thing is you see what happens when you have actors who are allowed to grow in roles on stage. And then when they do finally get that shot at a film or a television program that allows them to do something incredible, they've got all that experience of work behind them that informs it. So one really does inform the other.
And so the issue kind of seems like, when you're talking about performance, mm-hmm. specifically performance, it's a tough situation. It's you know, I'm very pro-union, obviously. I'm very pro-working class. I'm proletariat. I have that kind of mentality. I'm very liberal and progressive. But I also came from a state there are very few unions in Texas. Texas is just not that, and you know, it's a very conservative state, mm-hmm. and there's probably a long history of union busting there, but regardless of if you came up through those ranks, if you're like me and you just grew up in Texas and you didn't know any different, you didn't grow up with the union sensibility. And so then I come out to New York and then I come to Los Angeles and I do work in entertainment also. I'm SAG-AFTRA not because I'm an actress, but because SAG and AFTRA merged, and if you
for hosting, yeah.
Yeah, for hosting. And so AFTRA, well, actually, you know what's weird? It's not even for hosting. My AFTRA membership is for broadcast. It's for journalism.
Ah.
Yeah, it's very strange. So just anybody who doesn't know, SAG was for a very long time the actors union, and AFTRA was kind of the TV union. So it could be that you were an actor. It could be that you were, so SAG was screen acting. So that's like film. And then AFTRA was the American
Federation of Radio and Television Artists.
Exactly. Radio and Television Artists. And so I do a job that requires that I be SAG-AFTRA, so I'm SAG-AFTRA. One job.
And must join.
Exactly. So there are things about it that frustrate me because it's almost like, I'm on the fence about it because I obviously, the whole core reason for unionization is so incredibly important. It's to protect workers and workers' rights and to allow workers to band together to demand that they have fair wages, that they have fair treatment, like the breaks that you need when you need, you know, meal breaks at the right times that you get, that you're eligible for, let's say, insurance after certain, I'm not, but I'm still, I do Obamacare, I'm self-employed. But
over,
that people
overtime,
who,
things
exactly,
like that.
Yeah, that... Overtime, that's a huge one. And then on the flip side of that, coming from a state that was like a right-to-work state or whatever, mm-hmm. where you could just get fired for any reason and there's really no union to protect you at all, I also see freedoms that come from not being in a union. Like, for example, SAG-AFTRA have very specific rules about doing non-union work. And you're basically a scab if you do non-union work, and they could potentially go after you for that. The frustrating thing is that there are a lot of productions that are non-union. And so it's like you as the performer are in a catch-22. You're like, well, I don't want to go against my union, but I can't find a job that's union. And that's really frustrating. And so this sounds like a similar thing, this 99-seat thing, which is kind of like you're an actress and you do it for a living. But what about other people who don't really do it for a living, but they want to perform as a hobby, or they want to perform for fun? Should they be held to the same working standards as actresses and actors that are in a union because that's their livelihood?
Well, I think that there are different ways of accomplishing that. I mean, let me also just state for the record, I am incredibly pro-union. I'm Equity, I'm SAG-AFTRA. I actually worked for the Writers Guild of America for 4 years running their digital media program.
Oh, cool.
My husband is IATSE because of animation writing. Mm-hmm. So he's WGA as well. So we got a whole lot of union stuff going on at our house. And yay, health insurance. but given all of that, the thing that's happening with Equity right now is that there are some people who were unhappy with the current plan. And Equity has always not particularly loved this plan. And
gotcha.
So now what's going on is...
It seems like it wouldn't be. It was the plan that you don't have to meet minimum standards if there's less than 99 seats?
By minimum standards, do you mean minimum wage?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there are very few of the... There are a lot of contracts that don't actually pay minimum wage, so that's a whole other...
Exactly. So they're allowing this because of the 99-seat rule, but I'm sure Equity isn't happy about this either because...
So basically what's happened now is... There was a town hall a month and a half ago where a lot of people voiced concerns and spoke both in favor of the plan and, you know, people who dissented. And what really came out of it is this idea that actors in this particular town want to be able to practice their craft. And if they are willing to do it in a place where they are not getting paid, you know, a lot of money to do so, they should be allowed to do that and their union should not stop them from that. One of the areas of dissent is that people have said, well, there are a whole bunch of producers out there who are taking advantage of this. It's not just about, you know, membership companies, which are groups of actors banding together. But the issue with that, and that there are producers now who have, you know, very large theaters who they're giving directors money and designers money and putting money into buildings.
But not paying the actors.
Right.
Yeah.
And the reality is that's kind of skewed. Are there a couple of those? Sure. Will there always be producers who try to take advantage of artists? Absolutely.
And that's
so,
the job of the union is to go after those things.
Right. But the problem is the union isn't doing it in a responsible way. And they're not doing it in a way that's in reaction to what the members have wanted. Because what the members have come forward and said is, well, hey, A lot of members have put forth this idea of a tiered contract where it's tied to production budget. So if you're at a certain production budget, then you have to pay actors X. If it goes up, then you have to pay more. And that's very much in line with SAG-AFTRA's. They have a bunch of different ultra-low budget agreements. And even the Writers Guild has new media agreements that are very, very flexible. And in the most recent round of negotiations, they they added some minimums in for certain budget levels. And that makes sense. That's the idea that you're allowing artists to practice their craft, whether it's writing, acting, et cetera, to grow. And then as budget levels grow, everybody is compensated fairly.
Yes.
And Equity has come in and said, no, there are basically three prongs of a plan that they have presented. One is that you have to pay Equity actors minimum wage, which would absolutely decimate the small theater system here in Los Angeles.
Even at minimum wage.
Yes. And the thing is, their whole thing is, well, but it's, you need to pay actors a living wage. Well, let's all be honest. Minimum wage is not a living wage. And that's actually unfair to the producers because part of the Equity plan, the 99-seat plan, allows actors to give notice and leave their productions if a more lucrative job comes up.
But
if you're then forcing producers to pay a certain amount and
Then they probably can't argue that.
Yeah, but also there's
the
issues. There's two other things that are important to get out there. So that's part of the plan. The other thing is they've said, well, okay, actors, if you want to go self-produce, you keep saying all this artsy stuff is important to you. So you can go self-produce, but you can't do it in any organized fashion. You can't do it with a producer, which means that you can't get like insurance. You can't get things like workman's comp. So you're putting actors in a very unsafe position and you're forcing actors to be producers. And some actors are. I mean, I love producing, but not every actor wants to do both. Mm. And the third piece of it is membership companies. They've said, all right, if you're a pre-existing membership company, you can continue operating the way you are. You can continue doing shows. You don't have to pay your membership company members minimum wage. But your membership freezes on April 1st. So anybody else who comes in after that, you have to pay minimum wage, which means basically you could end up doing a show where like Hamlet doesn't get paid or gets paid very little, yet the person who comes in to do the page gets paid, several hundred bucks a week.
Yeah.
And that will decimate membership companies. It will create very, very uncomfortable situations.
So that's interesting to me as somebody, like as an outsider who doesn't act, and I think that the 99.9% of the people listening to the podcast are like, actors are poor.
So many actors are poor. Yes.
Like this reminds me of that time when I was first looking for an electric car, and I was tweeting to everybody like, "Hey guys, I want to get an electric car. Any recommendations? Kind of crowdsourcing ideas." And it was like, "Tesla, get a Tesla. How about a Tesla Model S? Sure. Get a Tesla." And finally, I tweeted something like, "Yeah, I don't feel like I should have to tell you this, but I cannot afford a Tesla." And I got all these responses like, "But you're on TV." And I was like, see, but this is the thing. I think that there's a perception, especially like you live not in Los Angeles, you've never even been to Los Angeles, and you have this idea that like, oh, if you're lucky enough to get a job on TV, like you're probably already rich, which is very, when you think about like a big budget movie, like a movie that was made for $50 million, and you look at the actors in that movie, let's say that they're like 150 different speaking roles in that movie. Like the top three billed people are going to maybe pull in like 2 million here, 5 million there, depending on who they are and what their rates are. And then everybody else is making like basically like SAG minimum.
Yeah, exactly.
This is very common. And SAG minimum is actually quite decent.
Right. But the thing that you have to keep in mind is it's not like you're at a regular job where you're making SAG minimum every single week.
Exactly. That's
the thing. You're jobbing in, you're jobbing out, your gig is over.
SAG minimum, something like 800 a day.
It's between 8 and 950. It depends on the budget tier, and it depends if it's film or television.
Yeah, after minimum for broadcast is like 350 a day. It's way fucking lower. And again, people are like, $350 a day, that's really good pay. And yes, it is really good pay.
If you're doing it every day.
If it's your daily job. But oftentimes it's like, oh, here's a gig, and then you don't work for 2 weeks, and then here's another gig. And that's, what we have to remember when a lot of... And yes, there are people who will do one commercial and make enough money to pay for college off of one commercial. But if they're not working at all, you still have to be very scrappy about like, oh, I need to save and I need to be smart because who knows when the next job is going to come. So it's a very different, it's kind of a feast and famine mentality. And it can be, it's good for some people. I love freelancing. I love that kind of, you know, I get a job, it pays very well. It pays like a half a year salary in 1 month. And then it's like, who knows when the next time. That's why I like having regular things that I do too. And that's why I have to work to help fund the podcast, right? Because the podcast, I put a lot of energy and a lot of my time into it. And it's my most regular thing that I know is always going to be there. But at the same time, I do it completely for free, which is...
Wait a minute. I'm not getting paid to be here today.
Nope, sorry.
I've got a great cup of water. So
that's true. And the smell of dumplings in the air because
the smell of dumplings in the morning.
Exactly. But yeah, so there's you kind of do the things that you can. Like I try and partner with advertisers to help support the podcast, and also I just opened a Patreon account so that it can be kind of crowdfunded.
What is a Patreon account?
It's really cool. Patreon is this. It's almost like Kickstarter or Indiegogo meets I don't know what, but it's almost like okay. It's like Kickstarter for ongoing projects.
Oh, cool.
So let's say that you are a comic book artist and you do, or let's say you're a comic strip artist and you do a new strip every week. Then what you would do is you would set up this account on Patreon and people can pledge to donate. And usually it's micro donations. It's like $2, $1. Right. You can do more. And there are different reward levels that you set up. Like once I can make $500 for every comic I put out, then I can buy this new set of colored pencils that I've really been wanting. Or once I...
Right.
And it's really helpful. And then you can also give things. Like people who donate $50 for every comic get a free signed, you know... I'm going to do 5 different lithos of it and you guys get those for free or whatever. And so it's
kind of like Kickstarter meets like old school patronage from, you know, like the 1600s.
Exactly.
Like everyone needs their patronage. King James.
Yes. And so that's kind of how it's been for me. And I just started it last week and it's been really cool because I've gotten so much support from people who listen. And I think that there's a certain percentage of podcast listeners that are diehard podcast fans who get it. They get that like podcasters work hard and it's free, but they also I don't want to ever change my model to where it's like a subscription model. Yeah. I just hate that. I want the people who can't afford to support to still be able to listen for free. It's a small percentage usually of your listenership. It's the same thing with like PBS, like public television. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets to experience it for free. It's a democratization of good content, but there's a handful of people who understand that without viewer support, it's not going to be able to continue. And so for me, it's a mixed model of trying to do advertising, but only with advertisers I really care about and that matter to me. And having kind of listener support and finding that balance because I want everybody to be happy. I don't want the listeners, you guys out there, to feel like I'm like reading too much ad copy and that I'm getting disconnected from the message. But at the same time, if I only relied on listener support, I wouldn't be able to keep the podcast afloat.
No, you just can't do that.
Advertising just pays a little bit better than that. So it's a tough thing. And it's kind of similar to, in some ways, what we've been talking about here, which is, it's that level of like when your job is also your passion, is also your creative endeavor, is also your hobby in a way. And where do you draw that line and talk about minimum standards? And so from the outside looking in, it's very easy for me to say because I'm not an actress and I've never had any experience with acting. I can't remember lines to save my life. Even when I do hosting gigs.
I was going to say, how do you remember them as a host?
Yeah, I just don't. Like, this is very common. So when I host, I'm very lucky in that most everything I do is very much like oriented towards my passion for science or my passion for politics. And there are things you have to do. Like we call them stand-ups, right? Intro copy, outro copy, things where there's a little line, you're walking, you're looking at the camera. I'm here at so-and-so to learn about this. And here is a fact that's really important. I fucking suck it though. Like I'm telling you, like I can usually get them in a small number of takes, but it's only because I put them in my own words.
Right.
And I'm still like, wait, what was the line? I can't remember anything. I'm not an actress. When people mistaken me for that, because they're like, oh, you're on TV, you're an actress. And I'm like, No.
No, but it is a big part of hosting. I mean, like, I host Marvel stuff, and there are definitely things I am allowed to talk about and not allowed to talk about. Yeah. And it's very specific, and there is no teleprompter. So
that's true. And I'm just very lucky that a lot of what I do is very scrappy, and it's very much like maybe I'm the only person on the staff, or I'm one of few people on the staff that actually have a strong science background. Mm-hmm. So even if I'm not a dedicated producer on the project, I'm still in some ways helping to content produce. Sometimes I am a dedicated producer and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm quote unquote talent. I was hired right. just to be on camera, but I still generally have the most know-how about that specific topic. And so I get to just roll with it and yeah. kind of just, you know, go along with it. And then every so often the producer's like, what the fuck are you doing? Let's just take a step back and keep focused on this and make sure you say these words. Right, and it's like, yeah. Sorry, I was geeking out. It's like this recent shoot I'm on was, which I can't talk about what it is yet, but I got to go and meet with all these amazing inventors and really cool projects, and I got to ride a hoverboard. And I mean, there's just like a ridiculous, I got to wear a spacesuit. And yeah, I'm like a kid in a candy store. And
that's
so every
amazing.
So, yeah, I'm just like, yay, this is awesome. Let's talk about how awesome it is. And every so often the producers are like, rein it in. Come on, let's keep focused. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm here to work. You're right. paying me to be here and do this, which blows my mind. But so there are pet projects that people do sometimes. There are things that people do for fun, like podcasting. There's no mm-hmm. podcasters union. If there were a podcasters union, we might be fucked.
Oh,
we might
yeah, all you guys be would fucked. Be totally screwed.
Because there's a certain level where it goes, wait, is it worth it for me to still do my craft even if mm-hmm. I'm not making the minimum amount of money? Because if there were enforcements on these rules that said, oh, unless you make this amount of money, you can't do it at all,
right.
it would probably eliminate those positions. But it wouldn't just help elevate everybody else. It would actually eliminate those positions.
Exactly. And that's a huge thing that the theatrical community here is talking about. But like with you and your podcast, when you think about it, I mean, you do it, I assume, partly because you love it.
Mostly. Pretty much only because I love it. Exactly. It's not a moneymaker.
It's not a moneymaker.
The money I make on the podcast fully supports the podcast. It's yes. definitely not profitable.
No, because you have these very cool mics we're talking into.
Exactly. And these are like on their last leg too. Also, this my sweet computer. We're gonna take a break in a couple minutes, mostly because I'm afraid I'm gonna
She's
get that.
She's caressing her computer.
Exactly.
Right now.
I'm gonna get the lovely pop-up that just goes disk too slow.
Oh no.
2008, I think. 2008 MacBook Air.
Finally got a new one. I had a 2007. And Woo. Did you know that in the Mac store they have like different qualifications? Like at some point it's considered, oh God, I wish I could remember. It's like one of them's an antique and one of them is
like vintage.
Yes. Yeah. And like they each mean different things. They're sort of code words. Like one means, well, we've stopped manufacturing parts for your computer. And the other is, well, we can fix it here, but we can't send it out to anybody because we can't guarantee it can get worked on because it's so freaking old.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where we are. We're operating on bricks now. Did you get an Air or did you get a Pro?
No, I got a Pro just so I can edit on it.
I'm thinking about getting a Pro too.
Yeah.
Even though I love how light an Air is, I think if I get a really small Pro, it'll be more powerful. And they are making the Pros lighter now.
Yeah, They're no, the Pro better. Is much lighter. I mean, I actually just took out my lovely 2007 MacBook Pro. She's so sweet and slow because I had to look up a bunch of tax info on it.
Yeah,
it's funny. Tax time, yeah. And I was amazed at how much heavier it was. So there's a definite difference.
Oh, it's amazing to see how, I mean, we talk about this all the time on the show, just the incredible improvements in technology over, like, and it was reinforced to me when I was wearing a spacesuit the other day. Also, random tangent. You hear sometimes when people say Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin went to the moon with computing power that was less than the iPhone in your pocket. And this guy who is a spacesuit designer, who I'm assuming knows these things and mm-hmm. works a lot with NASA contracts, reinforced that to me. He's like, oh, that's completely true. I kind of wasn't sure if that was like a wives tale. And I also wasn't sure exactly how to check something like that. Mm. But apparently, yeah, we've got more computing power in like a souped up iPhone than we had in that entire mission control room.
That's crazy.
I mean, that's fucking crazy. It's just crazy.
Completely crazy.
So we've been talking a lot about, I want to come back. I want to talk a little bit more about some union stuff because it's actually like, it's something I've never talked about. And I think actors unions in some mm-hmm. ways, even though they feel probably a bit esoteric to most of the people that are listening, I think there are a lot of parallels here between what's happening with current unions and kind of the more modern state of workers and workers' rights compared to, I think, the unionizations of kind of mid-war and post-war times in America, when in some ways, I don't know, I don't think workers, well, I can't really say, you know, I think we think heavily about blue collar and manufacturing jobs when we associate them with unions. But of course, when we think about, you know, farmers union, there's still a lot of places where this is it's incredibly necessary everywhere. But what about when we start to get into the nuance, and how do we navigate those murky waters? So I want to come back and pick that up. And then I really want to start talking about sirens, because again, we'll get to it. And we haven't gotten to it.
We'll get to it.
Exactly. I'm going to take one quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, speaking of sponsorships. And then we will be right back with Tamara Krinsky.
All right, guys, I am proud to say that this week's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the website that I use to build my own website. KaraSantaMaria.com is a creation from my own mind that was made entirely by myself on Squarespace. Squarespace is simple, it is powerful, and it is beautiful, and you do not have to know anything about coding or web design to make an incredible website all by yourself. And if you do happen to run into any issues whatsoever, there's 24/7 support via live chat and email. Any time of day, you can get in touch with somebody. They will answer your questions so incredibly quickly, and they will be very attentive to detail. It's only $8 a month, and if you buy Squarespace for the whole year, you even get a free domain name. Now, guys, one of my favorite things about Squarespace is that the design is fully responsive, which means if you build out your website on your laptop or your desktop and it looks absolutely perfect, then all of a sudden you have this panic moment when you go, oh, crap, what's it going to look like on an iPad or an iPhone or an Android phone? It doesn't matter. It's going to scale down beautifully. The navigation bar is going to change to fit. Everything's going to shrink down. None of the code is going to look weird. It's absolutely responsive. Even turning your iPhone, the accelerometer to go widescreen, what do you call that, landscape versus portrait, totally responsive, still looks beautiful. Also, every single website comes with a free online store. So if you have a small business, if you want to sell your wares, it's a great way to get started, and you can have it up within minutes. Squarespace Commerce is included on every single Squarespace website. Also, there's this really cool new feature called Cover Pages. I don't even think that this was around yet. When I first built my website, it's a feature that allows you to set up like just a one-page online presence within minutes. So if you just want to get something up there, something that has contact information, something that is a placeholder, or just a single beautiful web page that doesn't have a lot of click-through navigation, literally within minutes, you can have that up and running and ready to go. So guys, don't wait. You can start a trial with no credit card required, and you can build your website today, like right now. And then when you realize that you've fallen in love with it and you need to get this thing live and you decide to actually sign up for Squarespace, do not forget, use the offer code NERDY. You heard it right here. You'll get 10% off and you'll show your support for the show. I want to thank Squarespace for their support of Talk Nerdy. Squarespace, build it beautiful. So I'm back with Tamara Krinsky, and we were just talking during the break about how I edit everything myself and kind of have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm learning as I go. There are definitely times when I get messages from people that are like, your audio levels were fucking horrible on the last episode. No. And I'm like, I'm trying, you guys. I'm hoping it's improving.
Putting that T in STEM.
Exactly.
Here we are on International Women's Day.
That's true. It is International Women's Day.
It is.
And I have a bunch of things I wanted to post for that. And luckily, we're up bright and early. And so I have the full day ahead of me to do that. Oh, that's great. Yeah. I have lots of cool stuff from Perimeter Institute, which I know you guys work with, that I need to post on social media. Oof. Sometimes I wish I'm a member of the Nerd Brigade, which is a group of 10 friends who are big science nerds.
Are there 10 of you guys now?
I think there's 10 of us.
Wow.
Might be 9. Ooh, whoops. Don't quote me on that. I think it's 10. I have no idea. And we do fun things. And mostly we just try to get paid to hang out, which is really fun. We're just a bunch of scientists and science communicators who love bringing the message to the masses. And one of the things that we recently started doing, which does not pay, because when I say we want to get paid, we actually don't get paid for anything really. But one of the things that we recently started doing was First Fridays.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't you guys just do a First Friday?
Really
which
fun.
I somehow missed on the calendar.
We've done two now, but we're going to keep going, yeah, as long as they let us keep going, which is at the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles here. We do a First Fridays program. A lot of museums do this, and it's really, really fun. So you should look and see if you have a local museum. Here in LA, the first Friday of every month, it's a ticketed event. They have bands play. They have amazing talks. The theme this season is about citizen science, like how you can get involved in science and a lot of like wildlife viewings and wildlife like aiding scientists to kind of survey wildlife. And there's also bars like all over the museum, and you're in basically after hours. You get to look at all the exhibits, yeah, still. It's super cool and swank. It's like a fun, it's a little more adult, but it's still all ages. There's, yeah, also food trucks outside. And so we've been doing this science salon, which is right after the main speaker in underneath the big whale, in the Otis Pavilion, which is right next to the Nature Lab. And we basically, it's very back and forth. 3 out of 10 of us each week will sit up at the front with mics, and then a few of us will sit in the audience with microphones. We wear these big buttons that are like, ask me about science. And then we run around the audience, and basically it's very back and forth. So yeah, one person at the top will be like, oh my God, I saw a crazy thing in my backyard the other day. Let me tell you about it. Have you guys seen crazy things in your backyard? And then people will tell their stories, right, and it's awesome.
Do you have anything crazy in your backyard?
No, I had no stories yesterday. I had absolutely no stories. But I'm also like dead tired from traveling for work. Right. And I was like, don't ask me to think. I will run a microphone from person to person. This is my job today. I will be doing next month's if they invite us back next month. And I have no idea what the theme is yet, but it will be a lot of fun.
Nice. I could have talked about Clive, our raccoon.
Exactly. See, that's the kind of cool, like.
Who actually turned out to be Clivette.
Aww.
Yeah, she was a lady raccoon who had taken residence in our roof or in our attic for quite a while.
Oh, she lived in your attic. What was
she eating? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the crazy thing was, you know, we were really worried about droppings because they're not very safe for humans.
Sure.
And, you know, she would come at certain times and then she'd be gone for a couple of months and be like, okay, yay, no more raccoon. But then all of a sudden, in like the middle of the night, you'd suddenly hear like,
oh, it's kind of cute.
It is the first time and kind of the second time, but then at 3 in the morning, like, yeah, 6 days in a row, not so cute anymore.
And poor Clivette's like, I don't know where I am. I don't know what's happening.
But, you know, and it's too early in the morning for me to remember the technical term, but they're animals, exactly, who come back and mark their territory and, yeah, they come back and visit and all of that. So we finally had to get somebody to come in and remove.
Forcibly remove Clivette.
Yeah. Well, and there's two different ways you can do it. There's like the folks who come in and they set a trap and they trap the raccoon and bye-bye raccoon. Or we had a more benevolent trapper who basically sets like a trap where it's a one-way trap in and a one-way trap out. That's two ways.
Yeah, no, it's a one-way in for food. And yeah, so they follow it and then it closes behind them, right? And then it's like a cage on the other side, I think,
well,
so they can release.
They come, you basically make clear everybody else out or clear anything else out that's in the attic. They set the trap. She comes in and then she can get out and then it closes behind her.
I see. So that she doesn't have that panicky kind of that moment of horrible panic. That's great.
Yeah.
I like that.
And then once she's out, they seal up the entranceway so that she can't get back in.
Gotcha. And that's, I mean, it is an issue. Like, we talk about urban wildlife, and it's like, it's again, it's the nuance. It's about finding the balance because, of course, we are invading their territory. Mm-hmm. But then in turn, it feels like they're invading ours. So he's like, no, it's my house. And he's like, bitch, I lived here first.
Exactly. And then, of course, like, we told our neighbors what were going on. And they were like, so you're getting rid of your raccoon, but then she's going to come and take residence in my attic. And we were like, I mean, maybe.
You're like, I know this great trapper that you can call. That's really funny. And yeah, so those are the kinds of things we were talking about. Hawks, and we were talking about raccoons, and we were talking about mice and different insects and just urban wildlife and how we can learn about the wildlife that lives around us and what to do, really, if you come across a coyote that is a beautiful, majestic creature, but also looks like maybe it got hit by a car or it was injured and, you know, I don't want to approach it, but I want to make sure it gets help. And so it's really informative, but it's also really fun because everybody has their great stories. And there is that nuance, you know, and I think it's, operating in the nuance is important, and we don't always do it.
No, we just put a post up about living in the question.
Sirens?
Yes, it was actually written by Taryn O'Neill.
Who is the last of the siren to join me. Although we are in talks about getting our calendars coordinated. So speaking of, let's get back into that. We'll come back to unions, maybe. I have no idea. Even though it's such a fascinating topic to me, because again, talk about nuance and gray areas. And it's like finding what's best for everyone. Somebody falls through the cracks. And I hate that. And also speaking up for the minority is very important. But then what happens when you start to take agency away from somebody? It's kind of like you want to protect somebody who doesn't have any other options.
Mm-hmm.
You have a farm worker who will take that job that's less than minimum wage because it's the only job they can get.
Exactly.
And that's very different than an actress who will take that job for less than minimum wage because she is supported fine and she doesn't need the money and she just wants to experience what it's like to, or she just wants to work on her craft.
Yeah.
And those are two very different issues. But we shouldn't also assume that anybody who acts is like, it's like a given that they just are independently wealthy or something.
No,
you know, there
it's
are a lot
far,
of people
far,
who are
far,
really
far
struggling. But then you have other people who go like, why the fuck did you choose to be an actor if you really want to make money? And so it is, it's a complicated, nuanced, I just put a button on it so I could move on. Speaking of acting and speaking of science, sirens, give me the elevator pitch. Tell me the top line of what sirens are, because it's such a great idea. It's such a cool idea. And I want everybody listening to Talk Nerdy to know about you guys
thank
so that
you.
They can follow you, because I think they'll love you.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so Sirens, and it's S-C-I-R-E-N-S, is a group of four science enthusiastic actresses. We all came together just about a year ago. Our official anniversary is February 26th. That was the day of our first tweet.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you. So we all came together about a year ago. The Genesis story is the origin story of Sirens, is that Taryn, who's the fourth siren, who hopefully all of your listeners will meet soon, was listening to a debate between Bill Nye the Science Guy and Ken Ham, who runs...
Oh, we all remember that quite well.
Yeah, well, as I'm guessing you and most of your listeners were similarly incensed, Taryn wrote this whole blog post about the need for scientific literacy in the general public and the idea that entertainment can be a way into that, especially for people who may not show a natural proclivity or curiosity towards science.
Or and, fear of science, to see it more ubiquitously in popular culture can help to kind of change that perception.
Yeah. So she wrote this piece, and in it she put forth this idea that actresses could be unlikely ambassadors for that, because the sad reality is when you talk about when actresses start talking about science, most people raise their eyebrows and are like, wait, what?
Yeah.
They just don't expect it to come out of your mouth.
Yeah.
And so when she put the blog post out, she tagged myself and Christina Ochoa, who your listeners have heard from, right?
Yep, totally. They listen to No Brainer already. If not, they definitely have heard Christina, because she was on the podcast, and I talk about her all the time, because she is the crossover ambassador.
She is.
She's both Sirens and Nerd Brigade.
Exactly. That's our bye, Christina.
Yeah.
So she tagged the two of us and a couple of other people, and she hashtagged it Actresses for STEM. And it started this small conversation on Twitter that started to grow, and finally we were all like, what is Actresses for STEM? I don't know. Let's maybe get together and talk about what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
So we started having some meetings and pie-in-the-sky conversations about what we thought we might be able to do together, what some interesting goals could be, you know, our passions for science, the different things we were all interested in. We're all sort of obsessed with space, and then we all have different areas that we've all focused on. And we've all come to it very differently as well, which is kind of cool. So basically, the group ended up being the four that, you know, so myself, Christina, Gia, and Taryn. And we have basically two different goals, one which is encouraging scientific literacy in the general public through entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is to create science-infused content ourselves.
Love that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, I know that you guys advocate for science all of the time. When you follow your Twitter, which is at Sirens, or on Facebook, you guys do a lot of great social media advocacy and sharing things that are really interesting and, you know, helping just raise awareness and get people interested. And so if you love to see, like, cool science tidbits, obviously these are some great accounts to follow just to fill up your feed a little bit more and round it out. And so I see that, but I guess I wasn't fully aware that part of your mission is to seek out work that kind of fulfills that promise. So obviously, Gia, as we know, because we talked quite a bit about Einstein's Girl, has like a one-woman show, a stage show that really embraces science and celebrates science and love. Yes. And the complicated, I guess, relationship between the two. But I wasn't aware that you guys were all kind of working towards, you know, maybe going out for auditions that, you know, reinforce that goal, or maybe working to produce your own content that reinforces that goal.
It's both, actually. Yeah. I mean, I think all of us would love to, you know, be playing STEM professionals on screen.
Yeah, but we can't make those. But we can't snap our fingers and say, oh, let's make there be, we can advocate for it.
Exactly.
But of course, and I think we all have many roles like that.
No, there aren't, sadly. And we all sort of have the personal goal that when we are lucky enough to get cast in those roles, to try and bring as much authenticity towards it as possible.
And do as much outside work, right? To promote that kind that character.
Yeah. But barring that, the idea of being able to create those roles, like I have a show called Egg Child that is currently in its, you know, nth state of rewrite, but it was a one-person show that was all about stem cell research trials and Alzheimer's and all of that. So
Oh, I can't wait to see it.
Thank you. Yes, hopefully. It was a one-person show. I did it a couple of years ago, and I'm now in the process of changing it from a one-person show into a multi-character play. So, yeah, it's that interesting process of, you know, you sort of do something in one form, and then you go, huh, I like parts of it. I don't like parts of it. There are some things that might be served better by a different format. So we'll see. It's cooking.
I love that.
And Taryn is a big sci-fi writer. So she's got scripts that are happening in that direction. But I think, you know, we're not really content to be actresses who just let things happen to us. And that can be one of the frustrating processes of being an actress. You are waiting around a lot. And all of us are united by this passion for science. And I think we're all very proactive. You know, all of us are multi-hyphenates. We all do different things. We produce, we host, we write, we sing. And being able to take our passion for science and put that into story, because we really, really believe that putting story and science together can help communicate that to a wider audience. And I'm sure as a science communicator,
it's huge. I mean, it is the ultimate goal. And I think it's also cool to see kind of this movement that's happening through things like, I've mentioned before on the podcast, this amazing documentary called Misrepresentation by Jennifer Siebel Newsom, and seeing Smart Girls at the Party, Amy Poehler's cool kind of initiative, and a lot of these strong female characters, seeing Patricia Arquette. Yes, seeing her her talk at the Oscars, and is that right? Yeah, it was Patricia Arquette.
Yeah, I was covering the Oscars, and it was amazing to see her. And then when she came backstage and she sort of expounded on what she had said, I was stationed in the winner's room. So basically, you know, there's the ceremony, the winners win, they come up, they trip over their dress, they do their thing, and then they go, they walk down, they get a bunch of photos taken of them, and then they come in the winner's room with a bunch of press, and they're all super excited and very happy and a little bit more relaxed because now they're not like, oh my God, am I going to win a work?
Yeah.
And a lot of times we'll ask about, you know, them to go into a little bit more depth about what they've talked about on stage. I mean, I actually was pretty psyched because I got to ask a couple questions to the Imitation Game writer who gave that wonderful, wonderful speech about Stay Weird. And
it's, I gotta say, what a great year for science and movies.
Oh, yeah.
So many cool movies. We've got Theory of Everything, Imitation Game, so many cool themes and like just smart movies this year. And I don't know, like things that mattered. And and to see it at the, I mean, okay. So here's my, I don't watch the Oscars. I'm really bad. Okay. I watch. watch the movies. I'm excited to watch good movies. But as I used to date somebody who was in the industry, like heavily in the industry, and he used to always call it rich people prom.
And I call it the Hollywood prom. I know Bill calls it that. I call it the Hollywood prom.
And I thought that it was telling. And I've gone to a few of those parties. You know, I went to like the Vanity Fair Oscar party, mm-hmm. like where put on the gown and get my makeup done and all that shit. And like, it's funny because, so you do a lot of, part of what you do when you host is you do red carpet coverage.
Oh, yes.
And you do big events like mm-hmm. the Oscars. So you were at the Oscars this year. And I remember thinking, that's like so many people's dream job. And for me, it's like my worst fucking
It's to me, it's surreal because like, I never thought I would grow up and do this. I mean, yeah. I always knew I would do acting. And the way I got into hosting was my day job as an act. Well, when I first started acting was I was actually a print journalist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I love interviewing people. It's kind of the flip side of like as an actress. Okay. So going back to my like superhero geeky roots, if I could have had a superpower growing up, mm-hmm. I would have wanted to be able to read people's minds.
Yeah, me too. That was always my go-to.
Yeah. So
everybody says it's a blessing and a curse, but I don't care. I'll take the responsibility.
Exactly. I'm so with you on that. So yeah, and then just somebody would need to invent a filter so we could, you know, the exactly, stuff we don't want.
Exactly.
But I'll take it all. So fast forward as an actress, when you're creating a character and doing all that, you get to figure out what's going on in their minds. So that's the creative piece of that. That's the artist piece of that for mm-hmm. me. But as a print journalist and as somebody interviewing people, you get to ask what's going on in their mind. And hopefully if you're a decent interviewer, you kind of get to find out a little bit of the truth. So was acting, was doing print journalism, and then I played kids for a really long time. Because your listeners can't see me, but I am 4'11" and smaller stature.
She's slight.
But then I hit this weird point where like it just didn't make sense that I was playing 18-year-olds anymore. But
you stretch it as long as you can.
Yeah. But no one would believe me as young mom. Nobody would put me in the DA's office.
Even though
yet.
You are a young mom.
I am. Well, now I can. I finally come out on the other side of it. So now I can play young mom. But there was this stretch where I couldn't. I was so frustrated and just banging my head against the wall. And then this hosting door opened up because I was comfortable on camera. I was comfortable interviewing people, mm-hmm. and I just kind of walked through it. And it was great, and I love it. And it, you know, it draws on every ounce of improv training I have ever
That's
had.
That's true. You really have to be on your feet when you're interviewing some, especially big egos, mm-hmm. big characters, people who will say and do weird shit, and you have to absorb it a little mm-hmm. and push back a little. You just have to, you have to play at their level. Like to go from interviewing somebody like, I don't know, like a Brad Pitt, not even a Brad Pitt, I shouldn't say that because he's actually kind of funny and warm and cool, but to go from like somebody who's really stiff maybe, mm-hmm. like a very famous actor who's very stiff, and then turn around to like interview a Zach Galifianakis type.
Right.
Like you have to roll with that, which is
hard.
You
totally do. I mean, there's all different kinds of personalities on the carpet. I mean, I've been, like I said, I work for Marvel, so I've been lucky enough to interview Robert Downey Jr. a couple mm-hmm. of times. And you have to be up for anything on the carpet with him. Like it's great because once he realizes that you're ready to play with him and play with the camera, it's a lot of fun. But you got to be on your toes.
Yeah, I definitely had. So I did some coverage at Wired, at Wired's booth at Comic-Con a couple of years ago. And it was fun. It was exhausting because I did like press junket stuff where you're basically in a room. You've seen these interviews all the time where there's a screen set up behind the person and they're kind of casual but fun and off the cuff mm-hmm. where it's like the same. Basically, the way they do that is the interviewer is in one chair and then the person or people they're interviewing are in another chair. And it's like a conveyor belt.
Yes.
It's literally like you have 20 minutes with these people. Their publicist is standing in the corner like, don't talk mm-hmm. about that. Do talk about that. Plug the movie. Get out. Move on. Oh, shit. The next people are waiting. And I, of course, and like have 1 foot in pop culture and 1 foot kind of out of it. So there are mm-hmm. definitely times when I was like, Game of Thrones. Okay. Never seen it. Fuck. What's it about? Read the Wikipedia page. Okay. Kit Harington. Go.
Right.
And so I definitely was able to interview amazing people like Bill Paxton, who's like my hero mm-hmm. because he was in Big Love and I was raised Mormon and he's from Texas and I'm from Texas. And I was like, my dad. And then like Hugh Jackman, who mm-hmm. is like kind of the same way. He's a huge character.
Oh, he's amazing.
He interviews himself, so it was like really fucking easy. But but that was also chill. I was at Comic-Con. I was wearing a Superman t-shirt. I was mm-hmm. laid back. I was interviewing Neil deGrasse Tyson, like friends of mine. It was just easy. When I look at what you do on the red carpet, like Like I said, I've managed to go to a few of those parties in the years that I was kind of dating people where that was their life, and it kind of felt a little bit like a weird observer. Like I was mm-hmm. there, but I wasn't there, and I was like, "This is weird."
Yeah.
And then I would go home and be like, "What a weird day," but I don't really know how I feel about it. I don't miss it at all. Mm-hmm. I actually kind of love that. Like, for example, I say this all the time. I'm podcasting with you right now on a Saturday, Sunday morning. I'm wearing pajamas. I'm not wearing any makeup. I basically rolled out of bed and then we were podcasting.
Why didn't you tell me? Because I showed up in an evening dress. Kidding. Hoodie all the way.
Hoodie, exactly. I don't like getting dressed up. I don't like putting on a gown and uncomfortable shoes and sitting in a makeup chair for 3 hours to get my hair and makeup done. There are aspects of my job that require that. Mm-hmm. I definitely, if I could choose the difference between doing a show in studio, which I've done, and doing a show out in the field, which I do quite a bit, I always would choose field. Mm-hmm.
Now, did you hear about the Ask Her More initiative for the Oscars this year?
Yes.
Which I loved.
It
so,
was huge. That's okay. Such an amazing – and this is that same kind of thing I'm talking about, this amalgamation of all of these great initiatives. So Ask Her More is a hashtag that was all over Twitter where it was like, stop fucking asking me about my dress. Yeah. Like you go up to a man and you go, what was it like to embody Alan Turing? And how did you feel when you were playing the scene where blah, blah, blah? And then you go up to a woman and you're like, who are you wearing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's fucked.
Yeah, it's really screwy. I mean, look, I have fun getting dressed up, you know, and I certainly appreciate what designers do, and I've gotten to wear some really awesome clothes, but at the same time,
nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with
enjoying being a woman, enjoying makeup and hair and shoes. And
but that's not all I am. That's not all the women on the carpet are. And when you talk about gender stereotypes, they're, you know, they took a look, the group that first started promoting this, and I'm totally blanking on it now, but we'll remember it later.
Maybe. I'll look it up while you keep talking.
Look it up. So the whole idea is that if men and women were being asked this question equally, it would be one thing. But they're not. Yeah, sure. Every once in a while they ask, you know, what tux some guy is wearing.
Yeah, but nobody cares. They're like Tom Ford.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, it's the 10th Tom Ford. Yeah. I don't care.
And so.
Oh, but, I think it is Amy Poehler.
Well, she's involved with it. There's a group
that started it.
No, she didn't start it, although they promoted it. I have it. There's an article that I wrote for Red Carpet Report where I actually go into the backstage coverage of what I was doing at the Oscars, and I talk about it there.
It's kind of hard to find here, like who first started it, because there's a lot of people. Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, well, I've been giving total props to Reese Witherspoon this whole week, because she has done a fantastic job this entire Oscar season of turning the conversation from, you know, sort of the typical like, hey, what are you wearing, to focusing on women's roles. I mean, the fact that she was not only a nominee herself this year for a role that she produced and said, hey, this is something I want to do, I'm going to get it out there, but she's also become a producer that, I mean, she produced Gone Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's amazing.
Yeah. So
and you see a lot of these great people, Lena Dunham supporting it, Amy Poehler, of course, Maria Shriver, and other interviewers like Robin Roberts, who's always on the red carpet, and then, of course, Gloria Steinem and people who you would expect. But
Lupita Nyong'o was talking about it.
Yeah, that's absolutely great.
I love that. So I love this idea that was put out there, and hopefully that will continue, because if all you ever ask a woman about is what she's wearing, the mani cam, the pedicam, which drives me crazy, then you know, you're not going to hear that more in-depth stuff, and that's what continues to promote gender stereotypes.
And it doesn't have to be like, how do you feel about the conflict that's happening in Syria? You know, it's like, of course, that's also not what you're doing on a red carpet.
Right.
It's a celebration. But it's not so much, because I'm seeing the very first comment on this one random article that I'm looking about. It is like, the red carpet isn't about discussing world politics. It's about self-promotion and promoting the designers. And it's like, relax, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, that's not the point. The point isn't that it needs to get heavy. The point is men and women are treated very differently in this situation. And so the same level of comments and questions that you're asking the men, let's ask the women. If we're going to go up to Reese Witherspoon, instead of saying, who are you wearing? Or in addition to saying, who are you wearing? So when you played your character in Wild, you know, did you have to take yourself to an interesting place? How did you emulate this character? The same fucking thing.
The same questions you ask the guys.
The same thing you ask Benedict Cumberbatch about, you know, Alan Turing. You don't ask him personal shit. You ask him what it was like when he was playing Alan Turing. Easy. Come on.
Yeah.
It's like so straightforward. Like it's weird that it's controversial.
I know. It's kind of silly.
But yeah, so going back to that, I fucking hate getting my hair done. Which is why I'm glad there are people
like you that
embrace that. I have fun that. With it as long as I don't take it seriously. But it is interesting. A friend of mine from high school just got back in touch with me on Facebook. And,
oh, I do love that when that happens.
I do,
like, randomly.
Yeah. And so, you know, he had seen some of the Oscar stuff, and he was like, oh, wow. He's like, tell me about the stuff that you're doing. And he was like, so did you go to parties? And I was like, no, actually.
You're like, I'm working.
This is my job. This is what I do. Like, I go and I prep and I research the people I'm talking to. Because the other crazy thing about hosting, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of the stuff that you do, you get longer chunks of time with people, which is great.
Totally. I'm very lucky that I don't do a lot of, like, red carpet reporting or that press junket was probably my only real experience with that kind of traditional hosting. And honestly, it's not my forte, I'll say.
It's an interesting skill set. I mean, what I've really had to learn to do is, and, like, thank goodness for my print journalism background, is you do your research so that you kind of walk that line. Because, look, when you have 3 minutes, you're not going to get in-depth on the Sudan. But you can ask somebody a question about something that they're passionate about, something that is of authentic interest to them. And even if they only have a couple minutes to talk about it, they're going to be glad to talk about that.
So, and, like, you can ask them something surprising. Like, if you do your research, you can figure, like, if you are looking up, let's say it's not an actor, but it's a scientist or somebody who just really matters to you. Like, think in your, everybody has somebody like that, alive or dead. Like, actually take a moment right now. Actually tweet me with it because I want to hear who it is. But alive or dead, if you could interview one person, and even if you only had 3 minutes, who would it be? And then the question is,
what would you favorite dinner party game.
Exactly. And but then the question is, like, what would you ask them? Would you ask them the same shit that everybody asks them? Or would you try and get creative to know something about them that maybe other people don't get to know? Or to, sometimes you can bond with somebody in a very close and quick way just by bringing up something that you read about them that you can tell is really meaningful and personal. And they go, oh, thanks for asking about that. Nobody ever asked about that. That really matters to me. And oh, I like you.
Yeah.
I'll open up to you and say more things to you than I would to that, like, dumb bimbo over there who is just asking me stupid questions about my dress. So, it's definitely a thing that requires, just like any job.
Just like anything.
The more research you do, the more you put into your work, and the more that you really, like, own your craft.
And it's also remembering, too, what your audience is interested in. I mean, when I was PBS had a show called Wired Science that I was a correspondent for.
Of course. Everybody listening knows Wired Science. We loved it.
You know, obviously the audience for that is very different than a red carpet audience. Yeah. But at the same time, you bring a little bit of your authentic self to it as well. Like, whenever I'm on the red carpet, if it makes sense and if it's appropriate. I mean, my audience knows me, so they know I'm going to ask something sciencey. You know, when I got to talk to the Imitation Game writer, it was, my question was, okay, you're focusing on something that is a very internal process, you know, the scientific process, the process of innovation and invention. You're working in a very visual medium. What do you think about that as a writer? And he was so happy to talk about his process because people hadn't asked that. People hadn't taken it from that. They talked about, you know, historical things and lots of other things, but...
And that's, you know what, I think that part of our responsibility, coming from different angles, but part of my responsibility as somebody who has a microphone for the podcast or somebody who does these web series or these TV shows that are sometimes more science-oriented or politically oriented, your responsibility as an actress who is also doing host work and who basically has this platform and has this microphone, I think personally, is to elevate the conversation. I was actually, random weird story, when I was... It's not even really a story, so I apologize. There's, like, no end to it. But when I interviewed Dawn Johansson for the podcast, which was maybe like 5 weeks ago, and he is the paleoanthropologist who discovered Lucy, who just first discovered Australopithecus afarensis in Ethiopia in the 70s. Amazing man, fascinating. We talked about anthropology, and we talked about human origins, but we also talked about atheism, and we talked about the scientific method. And we talked a little bit about science communication and how historically some of the old guard is really resistant to it. And then the publicist who got me in touch with Dawn emailed me.
Oh, no.
No, it's good. It's good.
Okay.
She emailed me and said, you know, my father was a very established print journalist in his day and – or no, not print, a television journalist in his day. And he – long story short, there was this story about a station, like a famous station manager that they had worked with. And I unfortunately, I don't think she can find the article where it first appeared, but I told her I was going to quote her on this in the podcast. I'm glad I finally have a chance to.
the quote was from the station manager, was something along the line, and this was like not, this was a long time ago when this conversation was had. It was something along the lines of, if you feed the people hamburger, they'll eat hamburger. If you feed them foie gras, they'll eat foie gras. And the idea is that it's a cop-out for the powers that be, quote unquote, whether it's the station managers, the network executives, the executive producers, all the way down, who say, well, we're just giving the people what they want. We see where the ratings are, and they want shows about Alaskans digging for gold with no fingers or cutting down trees. They want Kardashian-esque shows with a lot of drama. They want angry women fighting. You're not giving them any other options. And if we take the minor places from within the system where we can elevate the conversation, even if it's a fraction, even if it's a tiny bit, it's within the parameters of what's expected. It's not going to rock the boat so much. Ask Her More is a great example. Ask her about her work and not just what she's wearing. Nobody's going to blink an eye. Nobody's going to go, I can't believe she didn't ask her about her shoes. They're going to go, oh, that was an interesting interview. It's not that revolutionary. It changes it just enough that it still fits within the parameter and nobody gets mad, but it just elevates it so much. And if each of us can continue to use our respective platforms to have smarter conversations, I think that we'll be able to see that what's in the program guide on cable is not going to be so dumbed down over time.
I have to talk about something because I've been thinking about it for the last couple of days. So first off, that is exactly what Sirens is all about. You know, elevating the conversation, using our platform as actors, as creators, to put forth some more interesting ideas out there and to begin conversations. And the amazing thing about the time that we're living in is if you see something in a show that piques your interest, you can jump online and find out more about it, and you can find out about it at any level. There's a Wikipedia entry, there's a kid's guide to it, and there's a very, very, very in-depth article about the video. So yeah. I love the time in which we live. I'm so happy about it. But that said, so I'm going to talk about Scandal for a minute.
Okay, sure. And I don't watch it, so I apologize in advance that I'm not really going to know what you're talking about, but I promise you people who are listening will.
So, and my point about Scandal is, okay, Shonda Rhimes, amazing TV creator. You know, she owns Thursday Night. She's got this incredible lineup of shows. And yes, I have watched Grey's Anatomy for all 11 years. So there you go. That said, she had this incredible episode on Thursday night that dealt with race relations. Mm-hmm. It was a story about a police shooting in D.C. It was a white cop who shot a black kid. And, you know, as the episode goes on, and in typical soapy Scandal fashion, you know, you weren't really sure until the end exactly what happened and who was at fault and the way it all went down.
Well, very, very timely.
Very timely. The thing that was amazing about it is, you know, a lot of people look at a show like Scandal and, you know, it's look at it as sort of high soap. It's very addictive. It's very fast paced. It's an awesome soap opera. Carrie Washington, amazing actress. Mm-hmm. So many people on
very
that show.
Smart.
Very smart. Yeah. Jeff Perry, incredibly founder of Steppenwolf, incredibly smart actor as well. I've been lucky enough to study with him. And so you've got all these wonderful, smart actors who imbue this very high-stakes drama, and there's always something crazy happening on the show. It's amazing. That said, what she did with Thursday's episode was all these viewers who have come along for this, you know, soapy, very entertaining television suddenly found themselves watching an episode that got to, back to that word, a very nuanced conversation about race relations in our country, about the relationship between the police force and a community, about the relationship between activism and the truth versus activism and PR and a message that is correct or not correct.
Kind of like Rosa Parks. Like, we forget sometimes that Rosa Parks was not the first Rosa Parks. The first Rosa Parks was, I can't even remember her name. That's a problem. But she was like a teenager, and she was like, I think she was like pregnant, and she didn't fit the narrative. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, oh, let's wait until the next person refuses to go to the back of the bus.
Exactly.
Because it didn't seem publicity wise that it would have the same impact. And that doesn't, you know, belittle Rosa Parks in any way, but it does show that it's always more nuanced and more complicated than we think. And so, and it sounds like what she also did was she forced people to think.
Mm-hmm.
And she because the first thing we're going to do is we're going to go, oh, that horrible cop shouldn't have shot that black kid. Or somebody else might go, oh, that poor cop, he's being put in a mm-hmm. position, blah, blah, you know, depending on your background, depending yeah. on how you think about these things. And then good writing is going to force you to question your beliefs and go, maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe it's a bit confusing. Maybe the cop was in the right. No, wait, maybe the kid was in the right. And then eventually, once you kind of have that uncomfortable conflict that you're dealing with, you walk away going like, okay, it's sometimes good to like question your thoughts and your beliefs and not fully trust your, you know, that Colbert truthiness I always bring mm-hmm. up, because that's just, it's reinforced for us in our society, the way that our political structure is, the way that our news is catered to us, and the way that entertainment is so easy now yeah. that it's just kind of reinforced that we don't have to think that deeply about anything, and that we can just trust our gut and that first reactionary idea that we have, that first decision that we make, we'll just find reinforcement in it because we can find our own echo chamber and surround ourselves with people who think just like us. Because that's both, you know, it's both the positive and the curse, I think, of having media so available to us, because mm-hmm. as you said, you can look up something at all depths if you so choose, or you can look up something that's literally just a reinforcement of what you already think, and you can easily find the news that's right for you, the news that's fit for you. You can live in a Fox News echo chamber. Exactly. Or you can live in an MSNBC echo chamber and never go outside of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's exciting for me for the podcast. It's exciting for me in my regular life to talk to people who have ideas that aren't always politically in line with mine, that aren't, you know, it's like I hear all the time from going on Rogan's show. Mm-hmm. A lot of people when I meet them on the street and they say, oh, I know you from Rogan's show. And they'll say, you know, you made me think twice about how I think about GMOs, or think twice, because the common rhetoric, if, you know, we're all just going to be like liberal kind of LA, you know, coastal thinkers.
Progressive.
Is that we, yeah, if we're progressives, well, then we should be anti-GMO and we should be like kind of protecting people's right to, you know, choose not to vaccinate their kid. And I'm like, fuck that. I'm informed by the science.
Don't get me started on vaccination.
Exactly. I'm informed by the science. I'm not informed by my politics. My politics mm-hmm. follow. Like, I yeah. look at evidence first, and that's most important to me. Well, I've kept you for so long. It's going to be a long podcast. Before we go, I have to end with the same things that I always end my podcast with, which are my famous two questions. And my two questions for you, same as for everybody else, are, when you look to the future first, what concerns you the most? What keeps you up the most at night?
Probably, I want to say, there's so many things, but mm-hmm. let's... maybe an odd combination, and I'm just thinking about this right now because of our conversation, because I have a kid and all mm-hmm, of that. Yeah. Sort of that combination of complacency mixed with overwhelm. I love the fact that there is so much information out there right now, but I do worry that we're just going to keep feeding everybody hamburgers.
Exactly.
And people will get used to eating hamburgers. And there's so much potential foie gras out there yeah. that they could bite into, but that it's too hard. It's too high. It's too much of a challenge. So people are just going to kind of keep sitting back and leaning back.
I feel bad that I even use foie gras as the example, because I don't think that's what they said. I think they said truffles. Foie gras has like a whole thing because it's like a cruelty yeah. food. So.
Okay,
I think so. It was truffles. It was truffles. Yes. So, but yes, if we did kind of keep showing them these truffles, that they would have this opportunity.
Yeah. But there, I worry about complacency. I worry about, you know, taking the easy way out, about laziness, about, you know, I mean, look, I'm as much of a geek as the next person, but like, you know, that if somebody's just sitting back and all they're doing is playing a video game and, you know, not ever getting out of their own universe and questioning things. So I worry about complacency.
Or all they're doing is leaving trolly comments on YouTube.
Yeah, that's a problem.
It's the worst. Yeah. So, but then on the flip side of that, what excites you? What, you know, makes you really hopeful?
What makes me really hopeful, and this is going to sound so nostalgic and sentimental, but honestly, is watching my kid, you know, and seeing the natural state of curiosity that kids are in, and I'm starting to understand, you know, how they take in some of their information. You know, she is 4 right now, and there's this cute little science class they have called Mad Science at their preschool.
Oh, I've heard of Mad Science. Yeah, it's like great. A nationwide thing, right? Where you have these cool volunteers, and they wear their cute little lab coats, and they have their own names, and then they do fun science projects.
Yeah.
I think I had a friend in college who was one of those Mad Science teachers.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. And the crazy thing for me, and this, of course, is totally anecdotal, but so the very first class she went to, and she knows that I love science stuff. Like, she is, you know, sort of half ballerina girl floating around in a tutu, and then she wants to be an astronaut, which I'm all for.
I love that.
So it's super cute. But she goes to her first science class, and she comes home, and I said, "Hey, so what'd you think of science class?" She goes, "Mommy, it was really fun." I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah. And you know what the best part was?" And I said, "What?" She said, "The teacher was a girl."
Oh,
now,
that's
this
awesome.
Is at 3.
Yeah.
And we've never talked about, like, gender and science.
So that's scary, too, because it shows that somehow she already is being reinforced that girls aren't supposed to be scientists.
Or just that she notices.
Yeah.
I mean, because she's got me as an example that, like, you know, like the other night she said, it was really kind of time for her to go to bed. And she was like, "Mommy," and maybe she was just stalling, but she was like, "Mommy, I don't want to go to bed yet." I said, "Really? Why is that?" She said, "Because we saw the moon and I want to go look at your telescope."
Aww.
So, of course, I totally gave in.
Fine.
Yeah. So, you know, there we go. And the photo from that night is actually posted on my Twitter. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But but that said, you know, their minds are so spongy and so interesting. So I do have hope that if we can just find ways to continue to feed that, to continue to elevate the conversation, to continue to, you know, feed what their interests are, that, you know, there's a new generation out there that'll take us to the places. And if we can, you know, foster critical thought, which is so important.
And that's the thing. I think we have to remember that this can't be a passive process. It has to be an active thing that we work really hard to embody. And especially when it comes to these gender questions that we're talking about, it's become status quo that the man of the species is the icon or is the symbol for the intellectual of the species or is the symbol for the powerful of the species. And it's become so actively a part of the culture that if we were to passively do nothing, it's got a world of its own. It takes off on its own. And so we have to actively work to show gender equity, to show gender balance, and to show what is possible, even if it's not what's actively happening in every corner of the earth. And I think the same thing, not just with gender balance, but with balance amongst minorities as well. I think people get annoyed with affirmative action, or they get annoyed with, like, feminism because they think
you're a big fan of affirmative action, right?
I'm a huge fan of affirmative action and, like, heavy-handed feminism. And I think that people get mad because they feel like, why would you want to tip the scales in the other direction unfairly? But I think that sometimes we have to tip the scales in the other direction in order for this scale to be balanced. So the
exactly.
scale is tipped so heavily in one direction that if we just go dink, 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 it's never going to equilibrate. Sometimes you have to knock it all the way down on the other side so that it can start to level itself out again. And so I'm not against that idea of being a bit heavy-handed about it right now, of making a huge effort, because I think all that's going to do is it's going to shorten the time between, because eventually things do equilibrate. Mm-hmm. We know this. We all reach homeostasis. Eventually, with enough active and smart minds, with enough equality and enough, you know, we live in a nation that really, really, of all the fucked up things that America does and of all the things I disagree with, I'm so pro the First Amendment. And I really do feel strongly about our Constitution. I think it's an incredibly important document. And with protected speech and with the availability for everybody to have the internet, the people who didn't have a platform before more and more are going to have a platform.
And that is why I'm so happy about the net neutrality passing.
Yes. Oh, yes. Woo! I wish I had a button to push like the yay button.
Here, I'll do that.
Thank you. And the truth is it's just a matter of time. I am a big advocate of making that time shorter so that we can live more of our lives in a place that's not so full of hate and fear and you know, in-group, out-group, nonsense, tribalism. It's just like, we're fucking past that. Like, let's look at examples. Let's look at ISIS. Let's look at examples of places where tribalism has run amok and go like, we don't need to be like that. And if we can find similarities with those people and say, oh, they're just like doing this thing that we do, but they've taken it to an nth degree, or they've taken it to a very dangerous, violent place. Like, that's fucked. And that's kind of sad. And we should be making a better example than that.
I'm all for it.
All right. I'm glad you agree.
Absolutely.
Sorry about the tirade.
No, I like the tirade.
Early Sunday morning. We're waking up, you guys. We're all waking up together. And for you, it's early Monday morning, probably, because that's when the podcast airs. So I want to thank first everybody for tuning in week after week to Talk Nerdy. I love you guys so much. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your support on Patreon. Thank you for your support rating and reviewing the podcast, and just for being here with me. I think now we're on like episode 52 or 53. I don't even remember. I know, it's crazy. More than 50 episodes. Huge milestone. So thank you so much for that. And thank you so much, Tamara, for sitting down with me, for having this like pleasantly random conversation about unions and about acting, and enlightening me in things that I didn't really know, and probably enlightening the listeners too into a world that we're not all privy to, that sometimes I think we elevate into the clouds a little bit, and humanizing it.
No, I think transparency is really, really important.
It is important. And, you know, I think it's cool to, you know, you're a person. Actors are people.
Actors are people too.
Exactly. And it's good for us to remember that sometimes, I think, and have that perspective. So thank you so much for joining me. And before we go, let everybody know how they can keep up with you, but also how they can keep up with Sirens and all the cool stuff you're doing.
Okay. So as for me, you can find me on Twitter at Tamara Krinsky. That's T-A-M-A-R-A Krinsky, K-R-I-N-S-K-Y. I blog at sciencelush.com. That's sciencelush.com, about the intersection of science and the arts. So you can find me there. And you can always find stuff about me at tamarakrinsky.com. As you can see, I make it really difficult to find.
Yeah,
I just
right?
Google my name and it'll all come up. You know, for a while I was Jersey Red on a bunch of things. And then I was like, yeah, I'm just making it too difficult.
No, it's easier when it's just your name.
And plus everybody kept thinking it was about tomatoes. And yeah. And then Jersey really is a big agricultural state.
Tamara Tomato. I love it.
There you go. And then as far as Sirens, you can find us on Twitter at Sirens. It's S-C-I-R-E-N-S. It's a play on screen Sirens for Science. You can find us at sirens.com. You can find us on Tumblr as well.
Tumblr. I haven't thought about Tumblr in a while. Tumblr's still it's a good website, though. It's a good way to see like quick bloggy posts with lots of cool GIFs. And yes, I say GIFs. Yeah. I don't say GIFs. GIF is correct. Deal with it. I like a good Tumblr.
Yeah, I'm not as well versed in Tumblr.
I'm not well versed in Tumblr at all. I do not have a Tumblr. I'm on some Tumblrs, but I don't have my own Tumblr.
I'm sure you're on some Tumblrs.
Yeah, when I do find a good Tumblr, though, I'm like, that's a good site, because you can get lost in the endless scroll.
We used Tumblr a lot for Frankenstein MD when I was working on it.
Yeah. Frankenstein MD. You guys remember? We talked a lot about it on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, so much fun. Oh, we should have talked about that. Fuck, I'm just going to have you back on. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you, everybody, once again, for coming along for the ride, and I'm really looking forward to the next time that we all get together to talk nerdy.